Welcome to the Tampa St. Pete Sports Connection Radio Show, live from Ferd's Sports Bar and Grill, providing a positive perspective from the peewees to the preps to the pros in Champa Bay. Now, here's your host, Mike Rickard.
For everything else in the community, so we really appreciate that, and we are proud of Brittany and the United States of America.
One last thing, Aaron Jackson, you know what? You look at that young lady's life, and you think you're a hard worker. I was like ashamed of my work ethic. How many degrees does she have?
Yeah, she's a tremendously bright student. I know that she has an engineering degree and another degree from the University of Florida, and just a super intelligent girl. And she just came on to speed skating 5 years ago.
Oh my God! She said that her hobby is education.
Yeah,
that's her hobby. Oh, by the way, I throw in a gold medal there too down the road. But education's our hobby.
Yeah, that's super. You'll not hear many athletes say that. That's for sure.
Well, there's two great young ladies and a young man who got bronze up there that are superb role models for people across the world, and especially Americans, especially young Floridians. With all the great snow coming from Iowa, it still shocks me that that success comes out of Ocala, Florida, but has a lot to do with your role and your wife's role in your young lady's life. And I applaud you, my friend, and look forward to meeting you and having conversation. We could talk sports all day long, you and I, Mike.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Thanks, Ferd, for everything they do.
All right, man. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
And he's Mike Bowe. He is Brittany Bowe's father, and what an impressive man. And I'm going to make a phone call. You know what? You're going to fill a little time here.
Can you hear me?
Can you handle it?
Oh, I can handle it. What a beautiful
day. That's Ray Kennedy, man. And I'm going to call my buddy Jim Foster and get ready to talk a little arena football, and we'll talk a little bit of Kurt Warner, and we're going to talk a little bit of Joey Burrow. How's that sound, man?
Yeah, and I forgot the St. Pete Grand Prix is coming up next week. I mean, we're in the thick of it down here in St. Petersburg.
We're in the thick of everything. You got the I'll talk about this real quickly. Okay, if you're a golf fan and you want to go down to Naples, you got the Champions Tour, the Chubb Classic.
Yes.
If you're a racing fan, we're going to talk racing a little bit. Drive over to Daytona.
Yes, sir.
You get the 500. It's only the Super Bowl racing. If you love collegiate athletics and you like women's fast pitch softball, you can go up to St. Pete Clearwater and the Elite Classic taking place just 25 minutes from here. And tomorrow night it's UCLA and Florida State at 7 o'clock, and that's on ESPN. And that's just one Saturday.
Well, I'll tell you what, while you do your phone call, I got to do a little shout out to the people over at 98 Rock. I was driving my kids to school yesterday. My daughter, my 11-year-old, she's just now getting interested in volleyball and basketball, and she's got the height. You met Rowan last week, and she's got the physical stature. And we won a 4-pack of tickets to go over on Tuesday night to see the USF Lady Bulls. They're 8-3 in the AAF or in their conference this year, among the top seed. They just lost. I'm trying to remember that. They beat Cincinnati last week, but then they lost to UCF the game before that. So Tuesday night over there at the Yingling Center, get to take the kids over and get to see some USF Bulls. So that's going to be great stuff. And like you were saying down here, I saw them setting up for the Grand Prix yesterday. I was driving down, and I was like, oh, yeah, wait a minute. That's right. We're getting right near the end of February here, and we got the St. Petersburg Grand Prix. So you've got a little bit of everything right here in St. Petersburg. You know, whatever your flavor. Maybe it's just beautiful weather, or it's sports, or maybe you're down here at the world-famous Ferd's Sports Bar and Grill having a great time on a Saturday like we are here.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad I put my mic on.
Yeah, I'm glad that you came down, because I wanted to talk about sending you out as a correspondent tell you what, let's go to the founder
seven,
of
0 5
oh.
Seven.
Yeah, so we're trying to get
Jim Foster.
Jim Foster,
the founder.
Yes.
Of Arena Football, and he was with the NFL prior to that,
right.
In the front office in New York. Graduated from the University. Yeah, I'll do his intro before we get him on.
Yes.
The University of Iowa, and ran track there. Got his master's degree. Ends up in New York. Pretty pretty cool job for the NFL.
Marketing guy. I mean, stands.
That was his deal.
Well, that was the one thing with the arena. And the Barnstormers, of course, infamous as far as the 50-yard indoor war, but the Barnstormers and the way they came at it. And, you know, we had the Tampa Bay Storm down here. And, of course, the Storm beat the Barnstormers in the Arena Bowl 10 there. I was going to give Jim a little grief about that, but I won't.
Yeah, he'll take that because he was in a precarious position because he was the founder of Arena Football.
Yes, sir.
And he was an owner.
Yes.
And I used to talk to him about that. I'd say, hey, this is kind of unique territory. You know, he wanted to see every team successful because they wanted every market. And you had owners like Bon Jovi owned a team. Jerry Jones owned a team. John Elway owned a team.
Yes, sir.
People don't realize the depth, and it became kind of a Hollywood, I've got an Arena Football team.
Oh, I love it. Yes.
And he got a trend going there, and it was very cool. And then David Baker, right. You may have heard of him. David, yes. Baker became his commissioner, and that monster of a man now is up at the Hall of Fame.
Oh, really?
That's where David Baker's at.
Well, and you know, you talk about the with the marketing, and you said that Jim Foster was, you know, the owner, then a commissioner. So he was the Bud Selig of Arena Football, is what you're saying here. Of course, Bud Selig was the owner of the Milwaukee Brewers back in the day, and he ends up becoming the baseball commissioner for a cup of coffee there. But yeah.
Well, Michael.
Jim Foster.
Am I on the right line or not?
You're on the right line. You're live, good. My friend. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, you're with myself and a gentleman named Ray Kennedy, who's very knowledgeable, and we just gave a glowing intro of your background. A Hawkeye, of course. You were in the NFL front office, and then we need to do, you know, forget the movie about Kurt Warner. We need a Jim Foster movie because every small businessman in America would want to watch it because of your commitment, your drive, and the success that you had of this dream that you put on a napkin.
No, not a napkin. You're one of those napkin guys. It was a 9x12 manila envelope full of press clippings on Iowa Hawkeye basketball, 1980 Lute Olson's team.
I love it.
And I'm living in New York, and you can't get any media coverage out there. That's why they've got Rutgers and Maryland in the Big Ten now, incidentally, for that very reason. So my mom and dad were sending me press clippings on the basketball team, and it happened to be an envelope full of press clippings on the Hawkeyes. And I'm, of course, sitting at Madison Square Garden. And incidentally, this was just in the last week. It was February 11th, 1981. That happened, that I drew it up on the back of that envelope. I pulled it out of my briefcase, my NFL pigskin leather briefcase, and I had a colleague from the NFL with me, a guy named Mark Fagan, that worked with me, and we went down to see indoor soccer. We'd never seen it. We thought, what the heck? And we watched the MISL Indoor Soccer League All-Star Game at Madison Square Garden that night, and we were probably halfway into the first period, and I looked at him and said, you know, if he could play soccer on turf indoors on a hockey rink, why not football? And he literally said to me, how do you think you'd do it? And I pulled that envelope out. First thing I saw, it was a big envelope, and drew the outline of a hockey rink, and you've seen a copy of it, I think, probably. Started making notes, and most of what's on there, including the nets and a lot of the stuff that got patented, the idea of going back to single platoon football, was written on that envelope that night. In fact, there's an exact copy of it now in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton. They got a display on Arena Football, how it started it, I guess. And I haven't even seen the display, but I guess it's pretty nice. So,
isn't that where David Baker, your former commissioner, ended up?
Yeah, and he just left there. He's done. He went back to California for a while, and a couple of the NFL owners were looking for a guy that was a pitch man, so to speak, and he was probably as good at that as anybody. He was a great stump speaker. He actually had been a politician. He'd been the mayor of Irvine, California, and came close to winning a congressional seat. So he had some political chops, and he was the great orator. That's how a lot of people in the Arena League looked at him. And we had some NFL owners, you know, that owned arena teams, and a couple of them said this guy would be great because the Hall of Fame was losing money, and they needed somebody to get out there and help try to raise some money. And that's why they brought him in. He was there like 6 or 7 years, I guess. But he's done now. I think he's probably retired back to California. That happened, I think, late October or something. I think he decided he didn't want to go through another winter in Canton, Ohio. I know his wife did, probably. So they were both from California. So
let's go.
They,
Let's go back to the Iowa Barnstormers. Of course, you create the concept, and then, as I alluded to in the intro, you own your own team, too. So you create the league, and then you have your Iowa Barnstormers in your beloved home state playing in Des Moines in what a lot of people thought was a rickety, rackety old, they called it the Barn Veterans Memorial, but I loved it, and you loved it, and so, it was a great home field advantage. So let's go from there to how it evolved.
If what, from the beginning with Arena or how the Barnstormers?
The Barnstormers, oh, Barnstormers. And getting Kurt Warner to play for you and great years.
From the very beginning when I came up with the idea for Arena Football, when I went through the steps to get it going, which involved, I did a test game in Rockford. I had to raise money. I don't come from any money. I'm an Iowa kid that grew up middle class in Iowa City, a great place, and graduated from the University of Iowa. And, I end up on the East Coast of the NFL, which was, a real eye-opener. It was a real gift from God just to get the job to be promotion manager of the NFL. And that's where I, of course, was when I came up with the idea for Arena Football. But I knew that I had to, I had to build the league first. And, that was quite a process in its own right to get that going. And quite frankly, it never would have happened at the level it did if I had not got the contract with ESPN, because that was the linchpin to give us national visibility and credibility and build the league over time. But I always, from the beginning, had an idea in the back of my head, or a thought at least, that it would be great to give Iowa some level of professional football. And I played the first year I came out of Iowa, I played for the old Minnesota Viking farm team in Des Moines. It's the old Sec Taylor Stadium, which was an interesting experience. And that was the last year that the NFL allowed any farm teams. They didn't sanction it anymore. They cut off any funding, any relationship after the 72 season because there were problems. There were teams stashing players. I eventually learned while I was with the NFL, I heard some good stories about some of the stuff that went on with some of these farm teams around the country that they had. In fact, I was enshrined in the Minor League Football Hall of Fame with a guy named Bobby Tucker. I think was his first name was Bobby. He was a great tight end for the New York Giants back in the 70s, and he would play for the Lowell, Massachusetts Rifles, I think they were called, in the Continental Football League on Saturday nights. He would then get on the train and take the train down to New York and dress for the Giants game the next day. They'd sneak him, literally almost sneak him on the roster. And he ended up turning out to be he was playing minor league ball on Saturday nights, and he was good enough that he caught some touchdowns and had some pretty big plays for the Giants, as I was told. And they started digging into it and said, where's this guy coming from? There were some other teams that weren't real happy about that because not all of them had farm team relationships. Some of them did, some of them didn't. And the Vikings happened to have had been the Des Moines Warriors, and then it became the Des Moines Vikings. We wore Viking uniforms. And my helmet, incidentally, had Joe Capp's name in it. So they'd send the stuff down. We had some guys that were taxi squad guys, basically. They would have been otherwise that were playing on, still playing on the team when I played there that one year. And then it was gone. And so I'd been involved at a very base level with, minor league football in Iowa, or pro football. And then, of course, I had the Nighthawks in Newton. That was a very successful team that I put together from scratch. And that was really my training. You didn't have any sports management programs at the college level. There were no internships, really. I mean, so I kind of did that on my own, and that's what got me to the NFL, quite honestly, was what I did in Newton and then Iowa with the Nighthawks. And then I come up with the idea for Arena Football. So I'd had all these steps kind of in the process of getting there. So by the time I got the league running, I'm thinking, I'd really love to be able to go back to Iowa. It makes sense someday. And I didn't know how the league was going to do. I didn't know. I had some ideas about that it was going to be a blend of medium size and large markets. I knew for television we had to be in major markets, but I also thought we had some opportunities in smaller markets. So I wrote into the documents, if you want to call them that, that I would have the rights to a franchise at some point or a team. And that day came. After I was commissioner for 6 years, I was time for me to get out of running the league day to day, because we needed a lawyer. It gets so complicated. If you're not a lawyer running the league today, you got serious problems, and you need lawyers to back you up. And I moved over onto the marketing side, which was a better fit for me at that point, given my background with the NFL. But I also had the time then to start working on putting the Des Moines team together. So that was in late 82 that I first started thinking about Des Moines. And I looked at a couple other markets. I liked New Orleans, thought maybe Indianapolis. But, you know, my ties are in Iowa. You mentioned it earlier. I love Iowa, my home state. I'm sitting here living on the Mississippi River in LeClaire, Iowa, looking out at Illinois, where my kids were born when we were in Chicago, putting Arena League together. But I'm on the shore, on the most eastern shore of the state. And I sit on my dock sometimes. I think you can't sit much further east in Iowa and still be in Iowa, but I'm an Iowa boy all the way. So my drive was to try to do it there. As you remember, we did a game in 1993 called the Rumble Under the Roof. And I knew from everything I'd done with arena football, you better understand in the market will work before you get there. There's been too many, and I'll say this in general, there's too many minor league sports franchises that are scattered all over the country that are buried in sports franchise graveyards, where some guy said, I'm going to put a team here because I want to. And they don't do their homework, and they find out that there was things in the market that they didn't understand. It's classic minor league sports franchising problems. I could write a book about it, probably. In fact, I taught at Iowa for several years in the Tippie College business entrepreneurial program, and I taught pro sports management marketing, and I taught that. You better understand what you're doing if you get into the sports franchise business, because it's real easy to lose a lot of money and tank a team. And then you've got fans that are upset, the ones that still love the team that are left. You know, how can you do this? You know, they want you to keep writing checks, you know, and just find more money to keep it going so I can go to the games. I understand that, but it's not a good way to do things. So I had to prove to the league, quite frankly, Des Moines is the smallest market that was ever in the Arena Football League by far. And the next smallest franchises were Milwaukee, Cincinnati, Hartford, Connecticut, and Oklahoma City. So, I mean, when you think about the size of those markets, Des Moines was pretty small. And long story short, that game was a huge success. I think you were probably there. You remember it. And we were treated like an NFL team coming in.
It was a party. It was an absolute blast of what you the product you put out there for us Iowans. We were blessed.
Well, and then, you know, we were able to, fortunately, do the same thing. That was a great game. That it was one of the few ties, actually, in arena football history between Danny White's Arizona Rattlers and the Cleveland Thunderbolts. And we couldn't have played out much better. It was a nail biter to the end, and then we didn't have the overtime rule yet. And I think we did. It went to overtime, and they still couldn't win it. So one way or the other. But it turned out well, and it set the stage for me to be able to come in and find pretty much local money, and Dick Jacobson was, the backbone of that, a guy that did so much for so much. You know, he's done a lot at Iowa State.
He's done a lot down here in the St. Pete Clearwater area, God rest his soul.
Doesn't surprise me, because he had a home down there, and he loved going down there. And, in fact, he had a home on the West Coast that he eventually got rid of down around San Diego because he liked it better in Florida. But I got to know Dick quite well. In fact, he just donated $70 million to build a huge new tower at the University of Iowa Hospitals, so Iowa has better health care for more people. I mean, that's the kind of – he just keeps giving. I mean, $70 million bucks, he's been gone for 8 years, and the foundation's doing it now. But I know he left behind some directions and some places that he wanted to put more money. And he's even given some money, I know, to Drake and you and I, you know, since he passed, so the foundation. So, he was an amazing guy. And the other limited partners, Bruce Harriman from Pella and his partner down there in the businesses they had, and a couple other fellas. I mean, they all stepped up, and it was a pretty good setup that we had, because it was an Iowa-based organization, people that cared about Iowa, and that's what I wanted it to be. And I wanted to really sell Iowa on a national basis. And I think I'm proud of a couple things. Was the guys that got a chance to play on that team. The teams we had there, including Kurt, some other great players. We had other guys go on to the NFL too, not just him, and have some success. But it was also the fact that we created an exciting entertainment, as you said, event factor for people, to come watch the games. We were the only, incidentally, the only team in arena football that had a radio network of any substance. You know, at one point we had 10 stations, including a station Coyle in Omaha, and WOC down here in Davenport, that were carrying the games, the flagship, of course, WHO with Jim Zabel, a legend in his own right in terms of sports casting. It was, we had some things going that made us an Iowa team. And there was some controversy early on because I said, I want to name this team Iowa. Of course, there were some guys in Des Moines, and I understood business leaders and stuff. No, it's just got to be the Des Moines Barnstormers. I said, no, to make this work, we're going to have to draw from outside Des Moines. And we actually did research, and we knew that 35-40% of our audience was coming from, more than 20-25 miles away from Des Moines. We had season ticket holders as far as Davenport and Mason City and down into Kansas and Missouri. And it was a pretty interesting thing. And we were on a lot of ESPN national television. That Des Moines had never seen national sports coverage like that before. I have a sports team, and I'm proud of what that did for Des Moines and for the state of Iowa, in terms of elevating its awareness.
We're talking to Jim Foster. He's the founder of Arena Football, and he had the Iowa Barnstormers as well. And it's well chronicled. Kurt Warner was his starting quarterback for a period of time, and the rest is history, his career. But one of the things that brought a lot of sex appeal to Arena Football during that period, you mentioned – your investors, your supporters, and us Iowans, you and I know that they were heavy hitters. But when you throw in a Bon Jovi in there, and then John Elway, and you throw in Jerry Jones, that also caught people's attention that this must be a entertainment option that has caught some of the titans in sports and entertainment's eye, and they invested money in it.
Yeah, they did, and they had some success, and they had some failure. And again, it comes back to George Halas said in the early 60s he had to testify before Congress because there was some question about the violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act on, contracts with players and how they were handled in the unions. And George made a very interesting comment to Congress, and it stuck with me, and I think with a lot of other people, but maybe not some as much as it should have. A league is only as good as its weakest link. So if you get franchises that get in trouble, it impacts an entire league. And you can go back and look at the NFL in the 40s and the 50s. They were struggling to stay above water. In fact, few people know that when Pete Rozelle was the commissioner, who was my boss at the NFL ultimately, that he was able to borrow money from a big guy. His name's going to escape me. He was one of the titans in Hollywood of MCA Records and studios. And he actually... Lou Wasserman. Lou Wasserman was a giant in Hollywood, and he was very wealthy, very successful. And he knew Pete Rozelle when he was the PR man for the Rams right out of college. And they got to be friends, and he personally loaned Rozelle money to keep the league afloat because it was struggling so much with weak franchises. And of course, when the AFL, the American Football League, came along, that was a significant challenge too. And they both survived out of it, merged together. That's all history now. But you got to have strength in your teams. And again, it comes back to good planning, good research, putting them in the right markets, and then running them properly. And that's been such a problem. For every league, even early leagues like the NFL, the NHL, the NBA years ago, you go back and look at the early histories, and God, they were all over the place. They lost franchises. They moved them in the middle of the night. There was all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, we certainly had challenges with the Arena Football League. And quite frankly, it's not here today. It's gone because towards the end, there got to be so much greed involved and too many people that weren't doing the right things fighting over everything that it imploded. And in fact, quite honestly, we lost the NFL. We had an option with the National Football League. I signed the document along with Commissioner Baker at the Super Bowl game in Atlanta that Tim DeWitt played in. That was like 1999, as I remember. And I don't remember the Roman numeral number for that Super Bowl, but that document was signed with the NFL. They had a 5-year option to buy half the Arena Football League. If that had happened, the Arena Football League would be very viable, very strong today. But because of some of the stuff that was already starting to happen with owners, there was just, you'd go to a league meeting and it was kind of like it's going on in Congress right now. I'll give you an analogy. It got so vitriolic and so nasty that it started to denigrate. It started to go, we started, and Baker couldn't keep control of it. And it was a downward spiral. So they, by two votes, did not vote at the end of 5 years to buy half of the league. And I say that that was the beginning of the demise of the league after that, because it struggled. You know, they had a bankruptcy. I got out of it, you know, eventually after the 2006 season. I don't miss it. I miss the game. And you made a very important point. The game works. And everybody has always said that. They love the game. John Bon Jovi, I got to know John. He's a good marketing guy. John, because he's marketed himself so well in his band over the years as they've evolved. But John loved the game for the value of it. You know, his partner was Ron Jaworski, who I just got a call from not long ago about the Kurt Warner movie, because he went to see it. And he called me to tell me how much he liked it, and how much he appreciated what I'd done to get the game going and everything I contributed, which was nice of the call. And guys like that, he mentioned Elway. Elway was an interesting character. He wanted to change a lot of the rules in arena football to make it just like the NFL. And I actually had some pretty pitched battles with him on the competition committee. But and quite frankly, I prevailed on most of it, thank God. But there were a lot of guys that did get involved that had stature, and they saw the value of it. The trouble always has been from the fairly early stages, as we got bigger and got more money involved, was trying to get people that could manage these teams properly and bring the right people in and listen to them. And that didn't always happen. And we weren't the only league to suffer from that. I mean, I'm saying that again. I mean, they've all suffered from it, but we had a very, very good product. ESPN believed in arena football. You know, we were on NBC for 2 years. But the problem there was NBC was a general broadcasting network. It was huge coverage, but a high percentage of the people watching NBC didn't know anything about arena football, and they didn't have enough time, the way it was set up in their sports department, to run additional what we call flank or collaring shows to promote arena football, like the arena football weekly show, talking to coaches and the highlights. And they couldn't really do it in the format we were in. And we realized at that point we really were better off on ESPN, where they could do more of that. And as over time, ESPN did give us more support programming around the games, because early on they put the game on, that was it. Nobody put the score on SportsCenter, and that was about it. Then they started adding highlights, and we became more of a recognized product. But that's always a struggle when whether you're doing a team in a market, or much less a whole league, is trying to build that visibility and that credibility. That was a good thing about Des Moines, was that we did get that. Just like Tampa, you know, I have to acknowledge the Tampa Bay Storm. That was one of the great franchises in arena football. I think the Barnstormers in that category too, but they were around for a long time. They had a really good coach in Tim Markham. I had some first battles with him. He was always trying to change rules, you know, so they favored what he wanted to do as a coach. He wasn't the only one, but he was probably the most voracious about that. But Tim was a good personnel guy. He found great players. You know, Jay Gruden, was at Tampa, was an outstanding quarterback that obviously went on to the NFL coaching. There were some tremendous players on that team. The fans in Tampa were fantastic. The Tampa Bay fan base, in my opinion, was probably about as good as they came. Arizona always had a good fan base. We certainly had it. There were certain teams that, you know, they dialed into it, they marketed it well, got the right audience involved. And Tampa was Orlando, I'd have to acknowledge too, as well. The Predators, and that was a big rivalry between the Predators and Perry Moss down there, another legendary coach, you know, who was really a coach at the NFL level. He was a head coach at the Canadian Football League. And he ends up in the early days of arena football and gets involved with me. And he turned out to be a really, really strong guy, not only in Orlando, but helping build the league credibility because of the kind of coach he was, you know. And Markham had actually coached underneath Mouse Davis. And I brought Mouse in as the original director of football operations because I needed somebody to really fine-tune that offense on that small field. And Mouse did that, and he did it very well for us, you know. I have a vivid memory of playing in Denver the first year, the Dynamite. Markham was actually the coach there the first year in the league at Denver, and it was early in the season. It was on ESPN, and Mouse was sitting on a folding chair down in the end zone behind the back of the wall, but he could see the field because there was an opening where they came in and out. And it was a high-scoring game, and I went down there to talk to him. He says, dang it, he says, I think we're going to break 100 tonight. You know, we're going to get 100 points. One of these teams is going to go over 100. And I said, this isn't an NBA game. And he said, no, it's arena football, and it should be just like the NBA. And offense was and is continues to be a part, even with the IFL and some of these other, I don't want to call them imitations. They are in a sense, but they're derivatives of arena football. They're cheaper to run because they don't put the nets up, which there's a lot more expense involved. And so for a lot of these leagues that are out there, they just put a little plastic goalpost up and play football. But the basic game is indoors, obviously. And guys still get to play the game. That's the important part. Just like I got to play football out of college for the Minnesota Vikings farm team in Des Moines. I mean, that was a great thrill for me. And then the Nighthawks team that I started, we won a championship. We ranked one of the top minor league teams in the country. So that experience of getting a chance to play, I go back to that, getting players an opportunity to play beyond college, different levels, whether they're D3 and they're good or they're D1, whatever. That has been a neat part, I guess, of my legacy, I guess, at this point, to know how many guys have got to coach, work in front offices, got to play because of what happened on the back of an envelope. So it's kind of come full circle.
Speaking of your legacy, and by the way, we're sitting about a block and a half at the most from Tropicana Field, where some of those great battles took place, and my buddy and your friend Billy McGee. But here we are in 2022 and 2021, and you're still arena football and your role of launching the concept, and the players and the coaches that came through are highlighted, and no more so than right now with Kurt Warner's movie out. And then a young man that took snaps in the Super Bowl last Sunday, Joey Burrow, his dad Jimmy, who coached at Ames High, and I covered him with my high school coverage. But then he came down and was on your staff, and I remember his other two boys played at Nebraska. But then look at the success that Jimmy Burrow with his family and of course Joey's had, and you can tie them all in some relative way to being involved with arena football back in the day.
Well, somebody pointed out to me, we produced two pretty good quarterbacks through the Barnstorm organization because Kurt Warner, obviously, and I will comment on the movie. I thought the movie overall did a good job of portraying Kurt and the focus he had and the passion he had, the drive to get to the National Football League, because that was very much Kurt. And that path came through Iowa. John Gregory, who there's this whole thing about why was John not in the movie. I don't know. I hope to get the answer to that someday. Because John, I was never a coach, you know that. I never introduced players onto the field or to John Gregory before the game. There was a lot of artistic license in the movie. In fact, they skipped Kurt's entire 97 season at Iowa. After the 96 championship game, they've got a guy from the Rams standing on the field looking for him. That didn't happen that way. And there's a lot of stuff that was embellished and whatever. But the pivot point and the focus of the movie is on Kurt, and that I thought was very well done. But the interesting thing is that John had a lot to do with Kurt's success.
And John was the head coach then.
He made a superb guy. Yeah, and he did a great job molding Kurt into a quarterback that could go on to the NFL. And to not even mention him really bothered me when I went, because I was hearing this, I was getting calls about it, and I thought, why would they do this? I don't have the answer yet. Also, the fact that I never put any cash on a table in a cafe in Cedar Falls or wherever it was supposed to take place, a meeting with him, that never happened with either John or me. Neither John or I ever, and I know this for a fact, ever offered him on the sideline $100 for throwing a touchdown pass in cash. He had it incentive in his contract.
I haven't seen the movie yet, but they actually portrayed it that you whipped out a picture of Benny Franklin for him to throw a touchdown.
Yeah, they show a scene in the sideline where he throws his first. It's the first game, and the crazy thing is, and you were there at the time, Mike. They show that the first game was actually played, ironically, on the road, an exhibition game that we lost in St. Louis, and Earl Bruce was the head coach down there, the Earl Bruce, who ended up coaching for me, as you remember, at the end.
I loved him. AF too. He was a hoot. I had a lot of fun going out for lunch with that cat, Earl Bruce.
And you know what? We would have been in Des Moines a lot longer if I would have known he was available when John went to New York, when we went to the AF2. I ended up had a bad coaching. In fact, that'll come back to Jim Burrows on that in just a second. But it was, yeah, they got, there were some things in there that just were, you know, not accurately showing. And what I started to say was we played in St. Louis. We got beat, and I have a vivid memory of this that very few people know about. They probably wouldn't have wanted it in the movie. I came down to the locker room after the game in St. Louis, and we got beat, and John's out in the hallway, and he looks at me, and he says, "Jim, God, I don't know what to do about this Warner kid." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "Well, I think he's got some potential, but," he said, "God, he didn't know what the hell was going on tonight. He was just lost out there. He threw three or four interceptions and one touchdown, as I remember." And he said, I don't know what to do." He said, "I said, well, you're not going to cut him, are you?" He says, "Well, we may need to get somebody else in here." Well, the backup we had was a big, tall kid named Lopez out of one of the California State schools, and he threw the ball. He could throw it through a wall, but he was not fine tuned at all. He was raw. He was a rookie. Totally. And I said, "Well, do you got any ideas on where to get somebody else?" And, you know, and he and Art Hagee were doing the personnel work. And they said, "Not really, you know." And I said, "Well, then, you know, John, he is a UNI graduate, just like you are, University of Northern Iowa." And I said, "He's from Iowa. Maybe we give this kid another week," because I wanted to, you know, have that Iowa flavor to the team as much as possible, because I thought that helped get more people to the games, which it certainly did. And, you know, we had a pretty good balance of great players from Iowa and Iowa State and some UNI kids in there, and like Kurt. And so he said, "Yeah, I guess we give him another week," because we had one more preseason game. And, well, the next week he threw three or four touchdowns and one interception. And John says after the game, he's starting to figure it out. He's going to be okay. That really did happen. Now, that's none of that's in the movie. But they instead show the first game being played in Vets Auditorium, the barn, and the players are coming out of the locker room, and there's cattle in the background in the building, like there's a cattle show going on. That was never cattle.
Like at the state fair.
Yeah, the state fair all of a sudden is in the back end of Vets Auditorium.
I haven't seen the movie yet. That was BS, because I was at every game.
That never happened. There was never any cattle in it for any reason in Vets Auditorium. It may have been nicknamed the barn, and it worked into our name and the whole and some of the imagery. The other thing that cracked me up when you see the movie is every time Kurt's driving, they show these aerial shots, and he's driving through cornfields on small two-way roads, you know, like there's no interstate in Iowa. There's no They never show them in the town.
That's how they portray us, Jim. Even down here, you know, Field of Dreams. You got to go.
Oh yeah. And then I don't know if you remember this, but the first year when we got there, we were trying to figure out our practice situation, and Vets was not that busy at that time. So they ended up, it worked out that we put our playing field down. And they just left it down unless they, on occasion, had something that they had to use the floor for. You know, they had very few concerts there anymore or anything at the time. And so I worked with the park board, and they had a park down somewhere down near the airport. I don't know exactly where it was, but it was a nice green space. It was even, you could run on it. It wasn't anything bad for practicing. And I went out, and I'd done this before at the Arena League level when we did some outdoor practice fields. We practiced at St. Joe's College down in Indiana, where the Bears used to have training camp for years, and they had some fields laid out. And we actually went and got the old square hay bales, or rectangular square bales. You remember what straw hay bales look like.
Oh, yeah.
And we played
on that long.
Well, they were put down the sidelines just to create where the walls would be for arena football. And it gave the players a visual cue as to, you know, what they were dealing with. Well, when you watch the movie, when you see it, I think they shot this in Pennsylvania. I was looking at the credits, and I got the impression some of this was shot in Pennsylvania. So they've got those massive hay bales that are round now. They're like 10 feet tall, you know, or they're big things. They're not anywhere near what we used. So they show this aerial shot of the practice field, and everything's brown. It's like they carved it out of a cornfield or something, or hay field, and they got these big hay bales down the sides, and it's so preposterous. It's not even close to what we had, and we didn't even practice there that much. We had it there occasionally when we had to go down there when we could practice in Vets, which is where we basically practiced indoors. So they make a big deal out of this, and they show the players laying on the hay bales, and all of a sudden Kurt Warner shows up out of nowhere. It didn't happen that way, that he just finally decides to come and play for us, you know, and shows up at practice. They showed him, he was struggling so badly that the players have the cars on there, they have lights on their cars, or whatever cars it was, lit up around the field at night so Kirk can practice throwing.
That didn't happen.
No, there's so much that didn't happen. I mean, it's artistic license. I mean, the main point of the movie is it's great about Kurt. It did bother me a little bit that he never mentions any play. There's never any mention of any of the players that played for the Barnstormers. And quite frankly, there's very little mention, even in the NFL segment. They only identify Isaac, you know, as one of the good receivers. Isaac Bruce, yeah. And actually, it's interesting because I think, now I think back to the movie, I think they had the name Isaac on the back of the jersey. And some of that might be for the reason. Yeah, and it might be just for the reason that they might have to pay him more money, you know, and acknowledge him and give him credits or royalties, I don't know. And at the NFL level, that's quite possible. I felt that the NFL portion of the movie was very well done. It was the best part. But I think it probably got a lot more scrutiny. I think the NFL probably had some involvement in that. There's no there's no Arena League right now, so who's gonna scrutinize that? And the funny thing is that when you think about it, Kurt Warner, as good as he did and as much passion as he had and the skill set that John helped him develop, which isn't really acknowledged to John because he's not in the movie, on both guys, and I've already talked about that, is the fact that he had some great receivers. We had Hrachek and Spencer from Iowa State. Those guys both went on and played in the National Football League. We had Willis Jacobs, who came down from the Canadian League with John, who was an all-Canadian League player, who was a phenomenal player for us the first two or three years, and helped set up that whole offense. John Gruby brought the run and shoot, basically, to Arena Football. Not run and shoot, but the live read option to Arena Football. Nobody really used it. Now it's prolific in the NFL. It's being used in all of our colleges. You know, our guys are running to a spot instead of running the old passing tree routes. And John, we won a lot of games early on because we had better receivers, a good quarterback, and people didn't know what we were doing with our offense. They didn't understand it. And I give a lot of credit to John for that and to the receiving core we had. I mean, and we had some other guys beyond that were terrific receivers. Carlos James from Iowa, who played both ways, was an Ironman player for us, you know, and a couple other guys like that. I mean, he had a lot of targets to throw to that helped make him what he was. And he also had two former NFL linemen blocking for him, Tony Catchings and Gary Howell up in front, you know, and there were a couple other guys that had some NFL time that were also in that line. So playing both ways because it was Ironman football. You know, there were a lot of things that went into making Kurt what he is, but essentially he did that. He got there because he had the will and the drive to do it. Obviously, he developed the skill set to get there and stay there and have the success he had. So,
we're talking to Jim Foster. He's the founder of Arena Football, and we examined some of the overlap in today's world with Jimmy Burrow and Joey Burrow. And, Ray, you had a question you want to throw at Jim?
Yeah, Jim, I got a question. So I saw the movie, loved the movie, and I know you said that they emphasized on the NFL level, but one of my favorites...
Did somebody ask a question? I didn't hear that.
I was saying, Jim, is that, can you hear me now?
Still can't.
All right, maybe it's just, now can you hear me, Jim?
Background noise.
Hi, so the uniforms, the Barnstormer uniforms with the with the aviator goggles on the helmets, right?
No, go ahead.
Can you hear me now, Jim? Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Jimmy, you still there?
Yeah, I'm there, but I really can't hear. I can barely hear a voice in the bathroom. Maybe you could repeat the question.
Yeah, he had a question on the uniforms in the movie.
Because they showed that. They showed the Barnstormer aviator goggles in the movie, and for me, that was a good part of the movie.
Yeah, the aviator goggles, your baby there, he wanted to ask about that because he did see the movie.
Yeah, the uniform was very accurately done. They got a hold of a uniform somewhere, which wouldn't be that hard to do. There's a whole Arena Football website now where guys are selling everything. I mean, helmets, footballs, programs, I mean, all kinds of jerseys. I mean, I'm amazed. I get on it once in a while, and I'm just surprised at how many people. There's a lot of people on it, too. So there's a following still, obviously, for Arena Football. But they did do the uniform very accurately. In fact, they even had the... 10th anniversary pass. It happened to be the 10th year of Arena Football when we played that championship game, Arena Bowl 10 in Des Moines in the barn. That incidentally was voted the number one Arena Football game of all time, not long before the league went out of business, I think at the 30th anniversary of Arena Football. And I'm proud of that fact because, you know, as the guy that started it all, I always had, you're going to have critics no matter what you do. And I had, you know, I had a vision of what I wanted the game to be and how we needed to do it. I certainly fought a lot of battles with owners that I mentioned earlier, you know, had other ideas and most of them didn't last very long, quite frankly. The good ones did, and I probably had a lot better relationships with them because they got a lot of what they understood a lot better how complex the business is, and it's not just as simple as I played football in high school in this town, and I was a great player, so I put a team here, everybody's going to love to come to the game, and I believe me, I actually heard that from some owners, you know, it's going to work because I was a football star in high school here, you know, so, I mean, it's a lot more complex than that, but the bottom line is that they did do the uniform right, the details of it are all good. They had to remanufacture the helmet logos, the goggles were, you know, that was an interesting thing because when I, again, coming back to Iowa, I wanted to do something significant with a uniform. I'm a creative person, you know, that from being around me. And I always wanted to, when I did that team, I wanted it to stand out. I always thought Michigan had an interesting helmet, look, you know, with the veins and the wings that kind of come back.
I can't believe you, as a Hawkeye, you even considered anything that was Wolverines-related. Come on.
Yeah, well, you know, and look, quite frankly, what Hayden did with the Tiger Hawk. What a mark that became its own. But I wanted to do more than that, and I wanted something different. And, you know, I went with the flying theme because I am a pilot. You know, I grew up loving the airplanes and I'm a member of the commemorative Air Force and, you know, and all the old radio. And I had an old radio engine airplane for a while in Des Moines. But suffice to say that I wanted something that went back to the history of aviation in Iowa. My dad's first ride in an airplane was in a cornfield outside West Branch where he grew up on a farm during the Depression in a barnstorming plane. So I knew a lot about that stuff, and I knew Lindbergh had barnstormed Iowa, actually, and made a living for a while flying around the Midwest doing that. Before he went through to St. Louis and became, or the Spirit of St. Louis and became world famous. So I wanted, and we had the name Barn, and it all worked out. Barnstorming, the Barn, you know, my love of aviation, you know, our flight, we had the flight line dancers and the Skyliners, the cheerleaders, you know, all that stuff that we did was all themed that way. Well, I was trying to figure out what to do with the helmet, and I was sitting one day looking at an aviation book on early days of aviation, and there was a guy sitting in the cockpit of an old biplane, an old Stearman, and he had the goggles up on his helmet. And I'm looking at that going, my God, could we reproduce that? And that's how that happened. And the wings on the jersey made sense. You know, we had the propeller down the side of the pants, which I don't think anybody's ever done before. That uniform has been voted several different times, I know, as one of the top uniforms in all of sports, you know, and the helmet in particular has been
well. You can go online, my audience. You can go online and look at that. I've only got a few minutes left here.
I got to mention Burroughs real quick.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to ask you.
When I watch his son play, and I watch the mannerisms, it's so much like Jimmy, and you got to know Jimmy. Jimmy was always laid back. He was cool. He was from northern Mississippi. He came from Jim Walton's the one that, you know, got him, you know, he went and played in Nebraska when Walden was an assistant there. And then he ends up, you know, coaching for Walden at Iowa State before that, you know, that fell apart up there. But Jim was a really good guy. He was a good football coach. He stayed in the background. He gave John the credit. You know, he coached the defensive side for us. And he did it. We had some great DBs, you know, playing there too at Iowa. And they, of course, most of them were playing both ways. So he had to work with the receivers as well. And he was a good player. You know, he played in the NFL a little bit, and then he was a star in the Canadian Football League. And he was very modest. He never talked about it much. But it doesn't surprise me to see what his son's done, nor the two sons earlier. Now, the young man that's playing in the NFL, starring in the NFL right now, that Jim was divorced, and that's that son came with his second wife. But the two boys you mentioned that were really good players in Nebraska and followed him to Nebraska, like he played there, were with his first wife. So obviously, it was a good gene pool there in terms of athleticism, but the mannerisms and the character and the way he carries himself. Jim had a little swagger to him, but it was very, very low key. But he was confident in what he did. He knew what he was doing. And he was supposed to be the head coach of the AF2 Barnstormers. Then we, as you remember, I won't get into all the details. There were some things with another coach that caused some problems. And that was the worst mistake in my career in ownership of not keeping Jim Burroughs as the head coach and going the way we did. But at the time, it was a kind of a political thing. And I wish he'd stayed on. But obviously, Jim went to the University of Ohio and did a great job there coaching. for a number of years before he retired, I think, when his son was a senior at LSU, so he could see him go down, he could get down and see him play, because he didn't get to see him play until that point in time. I have nothing but good things to say about Jimmy Broz, and obviously his son speaks for itself. So,
well, this has been a trip down memory lane for me, and I certainly appreciate you sharing with my audience down here in the greater Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater area. And I would love to see you come down here and visit, and you and I and Billy McGee can reminisce and have some fun.
Oh,
sometime.
Boy, that'd be a good one.
All right,
I love Billy. My wife sends her regards, incidentally, to you.
Oh, I appreciate
and
that.
And on to Billy, for that matter. And hopefully we will get down there one of these days, and we will get together.
I will see you at the Drake Relays, man, my friend, and I'll talk to you between now and then.
Okay, it was good talking to you. I hope people enjoyed what I had to say or got something out of it.
All right. He's Jim Foster, and we're blessed to have him join us. Talk about some history and the plethora. And, you know, I love the guy. He could have talked for 4 hours. Without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, he's that passionate about what he accomplished.
Yes, sir. And did it right. And the movie was great. You got to see the movie. The movie was fantastic.
Well, I apologize for bringing you down here.
Oh, it's fine.
But at least you got some of that history.
Love it. Yes.
I'm glad you saw the movie.
Yes, good. And you're going to love it. American Underdog. Great. American Underdog, I believe, was the name of the movie. But great. And the Barnstormer part was actually the best part of the movie for me, because they did get the uniform right, and it takes it to the roots, because everybody knows that's part of the story of Kurt Warner and the Infamous.
Plus, you went to the Thunderdome, didn't you? Is that what they called it over here?
The Thunderdome, when the Storm were playing in there. And
they set records.
Sure.
In fact, Mark Ferguson, we got a couple minutes. Mark Ferguson, the owner, that's where he proposed to his wife, Sherry.
Oh, I did not know
that. One of those on the big screen deals, and he had Billy McGee coordinating it all for him.
Yeah, it was actually originally the Pinellas Suncoast Dome, the Suncoast, Florida Suncoast Dome. Then he changed it to Thunderdome because the Storm and the Lightning were playing there. And, yeah, go back. But, yeah, good stuff. I loved listening to him talking about the...
Well, Michael Jones and I were going to talk a little golf. Yeah. We'll have to do that on a further date. We're launching on March 5th, as I said, the opening of the show. We'll be on from 11 to 12. We'll be talking all things golf. We'll be talking all things... We better start brushing up on Caddyshack and Happy Gilmore, because we'll be giving away all kinds. You'll have to come to Ferg, so we're going to get you interactive. Come on down. And getting involved in our social media, a lot of giveaways, and have a lot of fun doing that. You and I are going to expand our alliance, and you're going to be our roving reporter as well as on the mic. And there's so much going on in this area. We've got to have someone like you out there covering it for us.
You just point a mic and a camera in any direction down here, and you're going to get something. That's what St. Petersburg is all about.
Yeah, like I said, look at today. I mean, we can go up to Clearwater and watch world-class collegiate softball. We could drive down here to Naples and watch, you know, Hall of Famers playing golf, or we can drive over to Daytona, and I blew it with Andy DeLay, Burning Rubber Radio. Make sure you log on tomorrow to Hoovy.tv, and Burning Rubber Radio will do a preview, Andy DeLay, tomorrow on Burning Rubber Radio on Hoovy.tv. Well, that kind of flew by when we got old Jim. Those were the conversations I used to have back in the day with him.
You can't buy stories like that.
No. Boy, and talk about a passionate guy that saw his baby. He was crushed. And we can talk about that off the air, what actually took place.
With the New York move and everything?
Well, with everything with arena football and the greed that cost that.
Right.
If the NFL would have been partners, that would have been the AAA league, as you're well aware of.
Same thing happened with the USFL. Of course, the USFL starting back up in another month and a half. But, you know, these people got to remember, stay within themselves. And then the Arena League was there. It was solid.
All right. So for Ray Kennedy, Mike Bowe, of course, Brittany Bowe's father, Jim Foster. Sorry, Andy DeLay. We'll get back to you, my man. Joe Berdahl, Big Ed on the controls. I'm Mike Rickard. Thank you for listening to Tampa St. Pete Sports Connection, and wishing you and your families a fabulous week. God bless you. God bless America. And have a championship week.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1,
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3,
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3.
Listen.